Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst.
Today, we're getting into a single, pretty dense source, the Washington Post Sunday edition. The official title is The Washington Post for Sunday, September 21st, 2025.
Yep. And our goal here is really to do a comprehensive dive. We want to pull out every key piece of information, every insight from this edition for you, the well-informed learner.
And this paper. Wow, it really paints a picture of a moment, doesn't it? It's just overwhelmingly dominated by the fallout from the Charlie Kirk killing.
Absolutely. It's a tragedy, obviously, but the reporting shows how it's cracking open these deep fissures right across politics, the media, even, you know, federal agencies themselves. It's quite something.
We're going to try and unpack all of that. The political heat, obviously, but also things like censorship, these loyalty tests that seem to be popping up.
And we'll contrast that with what's happening economically. There's real anxiety hitting households, plus some, frankly, startling shifts in U.S. foreign policy, some legally ambiguous ones, too.
Yeah, it's a crucial snapshot. Okay, let's dive right in.
So we really have to start with the most immediate, visible consequence, the memorial service for Charlie Kirk. The sheer logistics of planning this thing are a major story in themselves.
It's described as this blend, right? Part state funeral, part political rally.
Yeah.
That combination alone tells you a lot.
And the scale. It's huge. State Farm Stadium in Arizona, 63,000 seats.
And the VIP list is, well, it's basically the entire line of presidential succession planning to be there. President Trump, Vice President Vance, five cabinet members are all scheduled to speak.
That level of attendance, it just underlines how politically charged, how significant this moment is perceived to be at the highest levels.
And the public interest.
Off the charts. Over 200,000 online requests for tickets. 200,000.
Wow.
For security, they're talking Super Bowl level. Or, you know, state funeral level. It's an all-hands-on-deck situation. Secret Service, federal, state, local agencies, all scrambling under immense time pressure.
And that pressure, that haste, it showed almost immediately, didn't it, with that arrest?
Yeah, the Joshua Runkles incident, 42 years old, arrested just days before the memorial, felony impersonation of law enforcement, carrying a weapon into the prohibited zone around the stadium.
Now, Turning Point USA, Kirk's organization, they put out a statement pretty quickly.
They did. They claimed he was advanced security for a known guest, but they also admitted that the coordination was lacking. Basically, the Secret Service hadn't been properly looped in.
Which, apart from the immediate security headache, just amplifies that high threat feeling around the whole event. It shows how difficult it is to pull something like this off after, well, after an assassination.
Exactly. And the political division surrounding Kirk's death itself was just laid bare in Congress.
Right. The House resolution honoring Kirk, condemning political violence. Sounds straightforward, but the vote.
Not straightforward at all. 95 Democrats voted yes. Okay. But then you had 38 vote present and a full 58 Democrats voted no.
That split is really telling. What's the thinking there? Voting present versus no?
Well, voting present often signals discomfort, right? Maybe they disagreed with the specific wording, the partisan framing, but didn't want to vote against condemning violence outright.
But the no votes.
That's a much stronger statement. It suggests they saw the resolution itself as politically weaponized, something they just couldn't support. Even with the condolences, it speaks volumes about the toxicity levels in D.C. right now.
Meanwhile, outside of Congress, Kirk's widow, Erica Kirk, is emerging as a significant figure herself.
Yeah, the Post frames her as stepping very rapidly and very adeptly into this volatile public space, almost mirroring the kind of high-stakes emotional political culture her husband cultivated.
It's an interesting dynamic. The paper notes, she's kind of redefining the political widow role.
Definitely. She's maintaining this image, you know, the traditional Christian wife, but she's also actively engaging in political mobilization. Some experts, like Marie Griffith, see her potentially filling a void.
A void in what sense?
In high-profile conservative female Christian leadership. Especially since some major denominations are limiting women's roles within the church structure itself. Erica Kirk operates outside that structure.
And political scientists are watching closely. They see her less as just a grieving spouse and more as a genuinely skilled communicator for the modern age.
There was even a quote from a Turning Point spokesman saying something like, Charlie converted the young men, but Erica is coming to convert the young women.
Which is a demographic the GOP sees as a weakness. So her rise isn't just symbolic, it's framed as a very calculated political move.
Right. And this intense political atmosphere, this void, the raw emotion, It all created this immediate, almost reflexive backlash against criticism, a real chilling effect.
And institutions started buckling under the pressure almost instantly. The biggest example being Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Yeah, Disney ABC pulling the show indefinitely. It came right after this wave of conservative outrage about comments Kimmel made related to Kirk's killing.
And it wasn't just Disney feeling the heat, was it?
No, it was broader. The FCC chair, Brendan Carr, suggested Kimmel should face discipline. And crucially, major affiliate owners Sinclair, Nexstar, dozens of stations, they publicly said they'd stop airing the show. That's huge pressure on ABC.
There's some irony here, though. Disney CEO Iger, he's taken political stands before against Trump policies, axing the Roseanne reboot after her racist comments.
Exactly. Those felt like clear moral or political lines. But here, critics, including Hollywood unions, slammed ABC for what they called self-censorship, capitulating to partisan pressure in a way that, you know, could set a really dangerous precedent for any kind of political critique on air.
Even some Republicans voiced concern about the speed of this, the move toward censorship. Ted Cruz, for instance.
Yeah, Senator Cruz called it dangerous for government to put itself in the position of saying, we're going to decide what speech we like and what we don't, which is a classic free speech argument.
But then you have the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, wading in.
And that really raised the stakes. Her initial comments suggested the Justice Department would absolutely target you, go after you, if you are targeting anyone with hate speech.
Which immediately set off alarm bells.
Huge alarm bells. Threatening federal prosecution, a government action over hate speech, which is notoriously slippery legally. Commentators saw that as a major potential intrusion on core First Amendment rights.
And these aren't just abstract concerns about speech. We're seeing immediate, tangible consequences in places like schools and universities.
Oh, absolutely. Teachers, professors losing their jobs fast. Look at Texas A&M.
Right. The instructor fired, the dean and department head removed.
All because a video surfaced of the instructor discussing a children's book, a book with a non-binary character. That's it. And the university president resigned soon after. Just total institutional collapse under political pressure.
There was that quote from a state lawmaker hoping it puts the fear of God into every university president.
Chilling. And it's not isolated. Tennessee, Cumberland University, an English professor and a staff member let go for inappropriate comments online about Kirk.
And this is being encouraged from the top down in some states.
Explicitly. Texas and Florida school chiefs urged the public to report teachers for reprehensible and inappropriate content on social media. They openly vowed accountability and even talked about limits on First Amendment rights for educators.
The numbers show it's happening. Texas Education Agency got 281 complaints right after the Kirk killing.
This whole climate really sets the stage for one of the most provocative opinion pieces in the paper, an argument that America actually has a significant left-wing political violence problem.
Yeah, unpack that. What's the core argument?
The author points to what they call the sick joy and, frankly, celebration of Kirk's death that erupted in some corners of the left, especially online.
And they try to back this up with data.
Yeah, a YouGov poll. It found 91% of conservatives thought celebrating a political opponent's death was unacceptable. Okay, but among very liberal respondents, only 56%.
That is a huge gap.
It's a massive difference, and the author argues this reflects a normalization of extreme animosity. The piece contends that rhetoric labeling opponents not just as wrong, but as evil, as subhuman rhetoric they trace back through Democratic figures over the last couple of decades, effectively gives people moral permission for violence, or at least for celebrating it.
It's an argument about dehumanization leading to acceptance of violence.
Pretty much. Now, the piece does acknowledge January 6th as major right-wing political violence. But its main thrust, its provocation, is that the acceptance or even celebration of violence is statistically more prevalent on the left right now, citing things like the response to Kirk's death or the attempted assassination of Justice Kavanaugh after certain rhetoric.
It's clearly an editorial designed to make people uncomfortable, framing the problem's root cause squarely on the left's rhetoric and perceived lack of restraint.
Definitely a piece meant to spark debate. Mm-hmm. And this whole environment, the loyalty tests, the free speech crackdowns, the political violence debate, it leads us directly into the next major theme, the erosion of independence within the executive branch itself.
Starting with something really fundamental, the DOJ firewall.
Exactly. That historical norm, mostly unwritten, that the White House keeps its distance from specific criminal investigations to ensure impartiality. President Trump, according to the Post, has just openly shattered that.
How so?
by using Truth Social to publicly urge Attorney General Bondi to prosecute specific political enemies. It's a direct public pressure campaign.
And this came right after that situation in Virginia with the U.S. attorney.
Right. The forced resignation of the interim U.S. attorney, Siebert. He declined to bring charges against New York AG Letitia James and former FBI director James Comey, saying there wasn't enough evidence.
And the administration linked his departure directly to that.
Trump did, explicitly. Insisted Siebert was fired. Not that he quit, making the political motive incredibly clear.
And Siebert's replacement.
Mary M. Maggie Cleary, installed as acting U.S. attorney. Now, her background is notable. She had previously claimed she was framed as having participated in the January 6th attack.
Frame.
That was her claim. And she said that experience spurred her to apply for the U.S. attorney job. So putting someone with that specific, highly partisan history into that role immediately after a public demand to prosecute political foes, well, it raises serious questions about judicial independence going forward.
This pattern of demanding loyalty, of ideological purity tests, it extends beyond the Justice Department, doesn't it? Into science, even history.
For sure. Look at the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Sources inside the Office of Water reported being told to pause publishing almost all research papers.
Why?
Pending review by political appointees. Unless the proofs had already gone back to the journals. Now, EPA officials denied a blanket pause, but they did confirm a commitment to using the gold standard of science, which is often code for letting political priorities influence scientific findings or publications.
And even the national parks aren't immune.
No. There was a March executive order about removing improper partisan ideology. Following that, the National Park Service has been removing signs and interpretive materials.
What kind of materials?
Things referencing climate change in places like Acadia, displays about slavery, about the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, about conflicts with Native Americans. They're coming down.
What's the justification for that?
The Park Service spokesperson said these materials disproportionately emphasize negative aspects of U.S. history without acknowledging broader context or national progress. They claim it can unintentionally distort understanding.
So it's an effort to sanitize history,
mm-hmm.
to present a simpler, more uniformly positive version.
That's certainly how critics are interpreting it. It looks like an attempt to remove narratives that cause discomfort or challenge a purely patriotic view.
Okay, so we have this high-level pressure, these ideological purges. How does this translate down to the individual federal worker?
The Post has this incredibly powerful, really heartbreaking case study, a man named Edward Brandon Beckham.
Tell us about him.
He's a Trump voter, works remotely for the Bureau of Land Management, the BLM, out in Nevada. He liked Trump's overall vision, the conservative values, but he became deeply troubled by how the administration was treating federal employees.
Like what?
The mass firings, the harassing emails, and especially the strict return to office mandates. He thought it was cruel, counterproductive. He actually applied for an early resignation offer 3 times, wanting out, but was denied each time.
And then things got really bad for him personally.
Devastatingly bad. The return to office mandate meant a 3-hour round-trip commute to Vegas. This was while his wife was dying. He ran out of paid leave, had no money coming in. His son, who worked part-time at Walmart, ended up having to buy ramen and cereal just to feed the family.
That's horrific. Did it change his political views?
He wrote in his diary about being disappointed in this administration, called it Trump's failure as a leader. He recognized the policy was directly harming his family. But this is the core of it. When his son pushed him on why he still supported Trump, Beckham concluded it was too soon to give up on the vision. He rationalized the suffering, said the president's business mentality was necessary, and, well, some people would just have to suffer for the greater good.
Wow. That really captures the psychological bind, doesn't it?
Mm.
Where loyalty overrides even profound personal hardship.
It's an incredible distillation of the personal cost of this political moment.
Yeah.
And that kind of intense domestic pressure, the loyalty tests, the ideological fights, it finds a mirror in the global instability reported in the paper. Starting with a truly dire crisis in Sudan.
The siege of El-Fashir.
Yes. And we need to stress how bad this is. El-Fashir is the last major city in Darfur, not controlled by the paramilitary RSF, the Rapid Support Forces. It's packed with people, over 250,000, many already displaced by fighting elsewhere. If it falls, the humanitarian fallout is almost unthinkable.
The descriptions from inside the city are brutal.
Harrowing. Death everywhere, one resident said. Starvation is rampant. Diseases like cholera are spreading. Constant shelling, kidnappings, rape, torture. People are eating moldy animal feed to survive. The main water plant keeps getting hit.
And the medical system.
Basically collapsed. One hospital partly functioning, doctors overwhelmed, no supplies. They're reportedly using mosquito nets as makeshift gauze, only hot water, no disinfectant for cleaning. It's medieval.
Beyond the immediate human cost, what are the geopolitical risks if El-Fashir falls?
Experts fear it could lead to a de facto partition of Sudan. It would give the RSF control over vital farmland and, critically, open up smuggling routes into places like Libya, giving them access to weapons and resources.
And this conflict isn't just internal, right? Outside powers are involved.
Deeply involved, fueling the fire. The Sudanese military gets drones from Iran and Turkey. Meanwhile, a State Department-funded report concluded it's near certain the UAE is supplying weapons to the RSF paramilitaries. It's a classic proxy war disaster.
This global instability seems to be coinciding with a major rethink in U.S. foreign policy, particularly regarding Israel and Gaza. The Post calls it a democratic earthquake.
That's the term they use, and it reflects a really rapid shift. More and more prominent Democrats are openly calling to cut off sales of offensive weapons to Israel. It's a significant break from decades of almost unconditional support.
What's driving this shift so quickly?
Primarily the evidence of famine conditions in Gaza, verified by global hunger authorities, linked directly to the months-long aid blockade. That, combined with polling.
What does the polling show?
It's really stark. Quinnipiac found 75% of Democrats now oppose sending military aid to Israel, and 77% believe Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. 77%. Okay. Even across all U.S. voters, sympathy for Palestinians is at an all-time high in polls going back to 2001.
So the Democratic base is moving, and the politicians are following.
It seems that way. Figures like Representative Ro Khanna are pushing hard, demanding the U.S. stop sending bombs, recognize a Palestinian state. You even see it in local races, like the New York mayor's race, where Zohran Mamdani, a strong critic of Israel, is leading the Democratic primary.
But the administration's official stance hasn't changed.
Not according to Secretary of State Marco Rubio. He reaffirmed unwavering support for Israel and dismissed calls for Palestinian statehood as just symbolic moves that would embolden Hamas. A clear disconnect there. And related to this, the administration is making specific moves on immigration that affect Palestinians directly.
How so?
Documents show they've started applying an extra layer of scrutiny specifically to Palestinian asylum seekers. All their applications are being diverted for an additional review.
Regardless of where they're coming from.
Exactly. Lawyers quoted in the piece say targeting an entire ethno-national group like this with a blanket policy is unprecedented and suggests discriminatory treatment.
And at the same time, they're changing policy for another group from the region.
Yes, Syrians. They're ending temporary protected status, TPS, for thousands of Syrian migrants, giving them just 60 days to leave the U.S.
Remind us what TPS is for.
It's a temporary status for people from countries where conditions like war or natural disaster make it unsafe to return. The administration is now arguing that conditions in Syria, despite the recent fall of the Assad regime, no longer prevent their nationals from returning home. It's a major policy shift with huge implications for those individuals.
Switching gears slightly, but still in the realm of foreign policy and legality, These lethal strikes in the Caribbean.
Right. President Trump announced another one. 3 people killed on a vessel supposedly trafficking drugs. Mm. That's the 3rd strike, like this reported recently. And critics are pointing out the lack of any clear legal justification being offered.
What's the core legal issue?
It's the blurring of lines between law enforcement and the laws of war. Drug interdiction at sea is typically a Coast Guard mission, apprehend, arrest, due process. That's law enforcement.
But these strikes are using lethal military force.
Exactly, which is governed by the law of war. And for that to apply, generally, the target needs to pose an imminent threat of attack against the U.S. Critics are asking, how does a drug boat in the Caribbean meet that threshold? The administration isn't providing a detailed legal analysis publicly.
They're just asserting the authority.
Essentially, yes. Asserting a license to kill outside the law, as one critic put it. The Post draws parallels to historical moments where presidential power expanded dramatically with vague justifications, like the Gulf of Tonkin or the sinking of the Maine, especially when Congress doesn't push back.
And Vice President Vance's reported comments reinforced that dismissal of legal norms.
Yeah, he was quoted expressing disdain for people weeping over the lack of due process for these suspected criminals. It shows a clear administration viewpoint prioritizing lethal action over traditional legal constraints. And just one more foreign policy point, talk about Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan.
Trump wants it back. We gave it to them for nothing, he said.
The Post has an editorial discussing this. It suggests strategically, trying to get a small U.S. presence back at Bagram might make sense, as the Taliban apparently wants things from the U.S. So there's potential leverage.
But the editorial has reservations.
Big reservations about recognizing the Taliban government, which seems to be part of the potential deal. Given their treatment of women and girls, the editorial argues that recognition would be a grave mistake, even if getting basic rights is desirable.
Okay, let's bring it back home now to the economy. The paper paints a picture of growing pressure, especially for lower-income Americans.
Definitely. That post-pandemic consumer spending boom, it's fading.
Right.
And it's fading fastest for the bottom 80% of earners.
Why them specifically?
They're getting squeezed by the rising cost of essentials. Housing, groceries, and especially utilities. The Post cites spikes of 13.8% for gas, 6.2% for electricity. These aren't optional expenses.
So they're going into debt using savings?
Both. Racking up credit card debt, dipping into whatever savings they might have had just to cover the basics.
But this isn't affecting everyone equally. You mentioned a K-shaped recovery earlier.
Right. Think of the letter K. The bottom leg is going down. That's the majority facing these pressures. But the top leg is shooting up. That's the wealthy elite.
So what are middle and upper income folks doing?
They're being more strategic, maybe shopping more at discount places like Walmart or Dollar Tree for bargains, but they still have spending power. And the very top tier, the top 10% earning 250K plus Soviela, their share of total spending has actually increased significantly. They now account for nearly half of all consumer spending.
And businesses are noticing this split.
Oh, yeah. Restaurants like Chipotle, IHOP, Sweetgreen are reporting that their lower and middle income customers are pulling back, cutting discretionary spending.
This leads to that weird stagflation light warning. Explain that.
Okay, so stagflation is usually stagnant growth plus high inflation. Here we have high inflation hitting the majority and slowing job growth overall. But the overall GDP growth projection for Q3 is actually pretty strong, maybe 3%.
So where's the growth coming from if most consumers are struggling?
It's being propped up almost entirely by two things: spending by the wealthy and massive business investment, particularly in the AI boom.
AI investment is actually moving the needle on GDP.
Significantly. The Post estimates it contributed 1.1 percentage points to GDP growth. Think about that. AI investment alone is adding more to growth than the entire U.S. consumer base right now. That really shows you the skew, that K-shape in action. And speaking of tech and the economy, there's this huge disruption happening with H-1B visas.
The new fee.
The $100,000 fee, announced by Trump for new H-1B applicants, effective immediately, like 12.01 a.m. Sunday morning.
Put that $100,000 figure in context. What were the fees before?
Usually somewhere between maybe $4,000 and $7,000 total, so $100. It's astronomical. For many companies, especially for entry-level positions where the salary might only be $80,000, it's essentially a ban. It's completely unaffordable.
And it caused immediate chaos.
Total panic. Companies like Microsoft, Google, JP Morgan were instantly telling their H-1B employees traveling abroad to stay put or get back to the U.S. immediately.
Why the panic if it was just for new applicants?
Because there's immediate confusion and no clarity on whether it applied to renewals as well. If it did, companies wouldn't be able to afford to keep their existing H-1B workforce. Imagine the disruption.
So critics are worried about chaos at airports, people being barred entry.
Yes, echoes of the 2017 travel bans. And even if it only applies to new visas, the sheer cost fundamentally changes the program. It likely means fewer sponsorships, especially for junior roles, and could drive talent away from the U.S. So while high-skilled workers worry about getting in, the government is changing how payments go out, creating problems for vulnerable people here.
Right, the move away from paper checks for federal benefits.
Treasury is stopping paper checks for most programs, Social Security, tax refunds by September 30th. Everyone needs to switch to direct deposit or other electronic options.
The rationale is efficiency and fraud prevention.
Yeah, electronic payments are cheaper, like 15 cents versus 50 cents per transaction, and check fraud nearly doubled recently, so there are valid reasons.
But the impact?
It's potentially huge for the 5 million or so beneficiaries who still get paper checks. Many are seniors, disabled, or part of the unbanked population. They might not have bank accounts, or they might be wary of digital payments due to scams.
And the timeline is very short.
Extremely short. Advocates worry many won't even know about the change until their check just doesn't arrive. The government says hardship waivers will be available, but only in rare circumstances. It looks like a recipe for significant disruption for vulnerable groups.
And one last economic point is that the job market itself. Hiring is slowing, Unemployment is up slightly.
And employer ghosting is on the rise.
Explain ghosting in this context.
It's when companies just cut off contact with job applicants after interviews. No rejection, no feedback, just silence.
And this is happening more now.
Apparently so. An Indeed survey found 40% of job seekers reported being ghosted after a second or third interview. That's up from 30% in 2022. As the market weakens, employers feel less pressure to treat applicants well, it seems.
The advice for job seekers is pretty bleak.
Yeah, basically. Keep trying to communicate professionally, ask for a timeline, try not to take it personally, but most importantly, move on. Don't wait around for a response that might never come and miss other opportunities.
Okay, that weakening job market, the economic anxiety, it really sets the stage for looking at how government is or isn't functioning.
Right.
Let's talk Congress. The funding deadline is looming October 1st.
And the dynamic is interesting. Democrats seem to feel they have some leverage. Their goal is twofold. Win some policy concessions, but also convince the public that it's GOP spending priorities, not Democratic demands, that are the real threat if there's a shutdown.
What are the specific Democratic demands?
Pretty practical stuff, actually. Extending Affordable Care Act subsidies, reversing Medicaid cuts, undoing that administration fund freeze on foreign aid and state grants we talked about earlier, and getting assurances Trump won't just claw back funds later.
But is Congress actually focused on these funding bills?
The Post paints a picture of, well, distraction. They've only passed 36 bills into law this entire term. Half of those were just repealing regulations.
So what are they spending time on?
Things like censures. 5 members censured in the last 5 years. Low-level nominations. Political theater, basically. Not the hard work of funding the government or dealing with things like the stalled Russia sanctions. Agencies are just running on last year's budget autopilot.
It really does sound like performance over substance.
That's the overwhelming impression. And this dysfunction at the federal level has ripple effects locally in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area.
Like the Key Bridge reconstruction in Maryland.
Yeah, a direct clash. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy publicly warned Maryland Governor Wes Moore against using DEI contracting diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives in the bridge rebuilding.
On what grounds?
Duffy claimed those practices threatened timelines and budgets for this vital project. Governor Moore pushed back, stressing the bridge's economic importance. It supports 13% of the state's economy, and insisting on fiscal responsibility while also implying a commitment to inclusive contracting. It's ideology versus infrastructure.
And in Virginia, we're seeing state-level Republicans fully embracing the National Magier brand.
Absolutely. Candidates like Earl Sears, Reed Myers are rallying with figures like Young Kin and Ramaswamy. Lieutenant Governor Earl Sears, for example, pledged to end divisive politics, but in the same breath blamed Democrats for gender-affirming care for minors and vowed to stop it. The definition of divisive seems quite specific there.
Locally in D.C., there's movement on the Commander's Stadium.
Finally, yes. They've started tearing down the old RFK Stadium to make way for this new $3.7 billion mixed-use development aiming for the 2030 season. But the deal itself warrants scrutiny.
Why? What are the terms?
Extremely favorable to the team. The city agreed to charge the Commanders just $1 a year in rent for 30 years. $1. And therefore going over $1 billion in property taxes through 2059.
$1 billion. That's a massive public subsidy for a private enterprise.
Huge. It raises serious questions about local priorities. Is this the best use of potential public funds compared to schools, services, etc.?
Another local issue with national implications. Safety at Reagan National Airport.
Senators Warner and Kane are calling on Congress to reduce the number of daily flights there. This comes directly after Post reporting highlighted serious safety risks due to the sheer volume of traffic.
This relates back to that tragic collision earlier in the year.
Yes, the fatal January 29th collision that killed 67 people. The reporting revealed that air traffic controllers themselves had warned management before the crash that the traffic volume was unsafe and arrivals needed to be reduced, but those warnings were apparently ignored.
That suggests safety concerns were overruled by pressure to maintain flex schedules.
That's the clear implication, a systemic failure to prioritize safety.
And just for a moment of local weirdness, the alligator.
Huh. Yes, apparently a juvenile alligator showed up in the Potomac River near the wharf. A local resident actually caught it with a net. They sent it off to a sanctuary in Pennsylvania. You never know what you'll find in the Potomac, I guess.
Okay, let's shift now towards culture, sports, ideas. Some interesting pieces here, too.
Starting with baseball, MLB. The Washington Nationals are described as kind of directionless right now, searching for a new GM after Rizzo and Martinez left. But there's a much bigger league-wide issue brewing.
Commissioner Manfred's plan for TV rights.
Exactly. He wants to consolidate all 30 teams' local TV rights by 2028. Pool the revenue, eliminate local blackouts. It sounds potentially good for fans.
But the big market teams must hate it.
Oh, absolutely. Teams like the Yankees, the Dodgers, they make hundreds of millions from their local deals. They have to give that up, put it into a shared pot. It's a massive economic shift. Probably hinges entirely on the next players' union contract negotiations in 2026.
The WNBA is also facing a critical negotiation point.
Yeah, if CBA is coming up, the league has incredible momentum right now. Huge crowds, like 16,000 plus in Indiana for a playoff game without Caitlin Clark. The game is growing fast.
But the players want a bigger piece of the pie.
They want a 50-50 revenue split, similar to the NBA. And they're basically warning the owners, don't screw this up. Don't kill this momentum by being greedy and resisting fair compensation for the players driving the growth. It's a high-stakes moment for the league.
Quick hits from College Football Weekend.
Some notable results. Number 17, Texas Tech beat number 16, Utah, pretty handily. 34-10. Their backup QB, Will Hammond, came in after an injury and played great.
And Oklahoma.
Number 11, Oklahoma beat number 22, Auburn, 24-17. The big story there was Oklahoma's defense setting a school record with 10 sacks against their former QB, Jackson Arnold, who transferred to Auburn. Mateer ran for the winning TD late.
And in the NFL, the Commanders are coming off their mini bye week. Does that rest help?
Players and coaches seem split on it. Some say the physical rest is huge. Others say it's all mental. Or worse, it just gives you more time to stew over the previous loss. Shows the psychology of the game. A couple other baseball notes. The Baltimore Orioles officially clinched a losing season with their 82nd loss. Tough year for them. But on the upside for DC fans, Nationals rookie Dalen Lyle hit an inside-the-park home run in the 11th inning to beat the Mets. That's exciting.
And in track and field.
Anna Hall won the world heptathlon title. She's only the second American woman ever to do it after the legendary Jackie Joyner-Kersee. She talked about rediscovering her love for the sport after injuries. Great story.
Let's move to the literary world. An obituary for Maxine Clare.
Yes, acclaimed author of Rattlebone. She passed away at 86. Her story is remarkable. She was a chief medical technologist, quit her job at 40 because she felt she was dying in some way, and decided to pursue writing.
Despite people telling her she was too old.
Exactly. She drew on her childhood memories of a 1950s black community in Kansas to write Rattlebone, which came out in 1994. Critics praised it for showing black life in all its complexity, going beyond just narratives of suffering. She really believed in pushing against adversity.
There's also a piece reflecting on the lost art of editing.
Through the lens of the late editor Starling Lawrence's notes, he was apparently legendary for his witty, sometimes brutal feedback. Hated cliches like battered briefcase, demanded realism.
Like the Doris Day comment.
Right, an author used the word surely, and Lawrence wrote something like, bad word, she sounds like Doris Day. He wanted precision, honesty, no sloppy sentimentality. His notes sound like a masterclass.
And in the world of ideas, a book review on effective altruism.
David Edmonds's Death in a Shallow Pond. It explores the movement sparked by Peter Singer's famous thought experiment. If it is in our power to prevent something bad from happening without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance, we ought morally to do it.
The drowning child analogy.
Exactly. Edmonds traces the history, examines the arguments for and against, and ultimately concludes the core moral case for helping distant strangers is hard to refute intellectually. It forces you, the reader, to confront your own choices about charity and consumption.
Now for some lighter trends. Shrinking presidential surnames.
Yeah. Some political scientists theorize that names are getting shorter. Roosevelt's, Eisenhower's, down to Bush's, Trump's. The idea is it's a branding advantage in our short attention span era.
Shorter names feel more familiar, more mass market.
That's the theory. More approachable, less patrician than the longer names of the past. An interesting idea about how subtle things might play into populist appeal when people are overloaded with information.
And technology in unexpected places.
The Lancet.
The robot lawnmower in New York's Bryant Park. It's like a giant Roomba cutting the grass. It shows automation working in complex urban settings, although apparently park staff still have to stop kids from chasing it.
Finally, the piece on SpaceX's culture. Yeah, focusing on how they innovate through speed and, well, ignoring conventional wisdom sometimes. It highlights an engineer named Matthews who reinvented NASA's docking system by just running with an idea once it got internal approval. Run a million miles an hour in that direction was the philosophy. NASA engineers apparently thought they were crazy for dishing decades of NASA's slower work, but SpaceX got the contract with their simpler, faster design. It's about that disruptive mindset.
Okay, before we synthesize all this, let's hit the advice column. Carolyn Hack's dealing with demanding birthdays.
Oh, this one was something. A husband writing in because his wife's birthday expectations have become extravagant and she's never satisfied. Like one year, he planned a hot air balloon ride, an elegant picnic, and she was apparently angry it wasn't enough.
Ouch. What's Hax's advice?
Pretty blunt. She tells him he needs to opt out of planning entirely. But crucially, he needs to write her a letter now, well before the birthday, clearly stating he's out of the birthday business because her demands are a hole I cannot fill.
So manage expectations brutally, but ahead of time.
Exactly. Avoid the inevitable disappointment and argument on the day itself by setting the boundary clearly and early. Tough love advice.
And lastly, a restaurant review for DC locals.
Par Bazaard, Chef Cedric Moutier's new place downtown. It's aiming for French Riviera glamour, a kind of dining escape. High-end stuff like caviar, but also more humble personal dishes like a rabbit pasta from his youth. It sounds like an interesting mix for these times.
Okay. We have covered a lot of ground from just one Sunday paper. Political violence, fallout, censorship, loyalty tests, eroding institutions, economic pressure, global crises, policy shifts.
It's really a snapshot of a system under immense strain, isn't it? From the immediate raw impact of the Kirk killing on free speech and people losing their jobs, right through to the almost methodical dismantling of scientific independence at the EPA or judicial independence at the DOJ.
And we saw how these big DC battles, these policy shifts, connect directly to individual lives.
Absolutely. That economic pressure isn't abstract. It's the lower-income families racking up debt for utilities. The policy shifts aren't just memos. They're the H-1B worker scrambling to get home, or the Syrian family losing their protected status, or the federal worker like Edward Beckham facing impossible choices.
So connecting all these threads, what's the big takeaway for you, the learner, from this deep dive?
I think it's seeing how these high-level fights, DOJ independence, EPA science, congressional standoffs aren't just political games. They have immediate, often harsh consequences for real people. You see it in Edward Beckham losing faith while his wife dies, yet still clinging to the leader whose policies caused him pain. You see it in the tech worker whose life is upended overnight by a sudden fee announcement.
There's a theme here about the erosion of predictability, maybe. The preference for political performance over stable governance.
That seems central. We see Congress focusing on censures, pure political theater, instead of funding bills. We see rhetoric justifying violence or censorship. We see rules changing based on loyalty. So the provocative thought maybe is this. In this environment where division seems to justify almost anything, is the biggest casualty, not just the specific person targeted or the specific institution weakened, but the fundamental expectation we used to have of predictable, impartial governance itself.
If the rules can change daily based on who's in favor or out of favor, what expectation of stability can any of us realistically hold on to? That's a heavy question to end on.
It feels like the central question raised by this entire stack of sources.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the Washington Post for Sunday, September 21st, 2025. We look forward to exploring your next stack of sources with you soon.